Barry to come up and share a story with us.
Thank you, Isaac. My name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic. What time do I stop?
25.
Thank you. That helps me. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you doing that. I know it's not the most comfortable thing. So, I'm an alcoholic, right? And there's a couple of things that are really important to me in being an alcoholic. One is my sobriety date, which is July 22nd of 2005. So tomorrow started this for me 17 years ago, which is amazing, and it was not my intention. The other things are, I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor since I got sober, and I have a home group, which now is here. So, you know, these are very important things. I have several marriages that didn't last anywhere near that long. Like dried pasta doesn't last that long. It's kind of cool, you know. I think that's important. You know, being an alcoholic, like, I didn't really... Well, let me back up. I grew up in Washington State on a farm, and I'm the youngest kid of, like, four kids. And at a very young age, I needed attention because I'm like way younger than my brothers and sisters, and they're all like doing stuff in the world. And no one, I felt, paid attention to me. So, you know, I would always do weird stuff. But what I discovered early on was I really liked feeling different. Like, we had a swing that was just like on a rope, and if I spun around and got off, it was awesome. And I did that so much, my grandma, I called her Nana, she was like, "What is wrong with you? You keep doing that and throwing up, and you almost fell in the river." And I was like maybe four. So there was something wrong with me from the beginning. I just liked being different. And being younger, by the time I was seven, like, I was smoking cigarettes. I, you know, would always bring dad a beer and, you know, take the foam off. I remember when I was five, there was a kegger, which we had several of a year, and I got to be, like, the bartender. I sat in the back of a Ford pickup truck, and I filled everyone's beer from the tap, and I would eat the foam off. And what happened kind of set the stage. Like, I woke up in the back of the car, not our car, but a car, without my pants. And that's kind of the way my life went from then on. Like, I don't know where my shoes are, but I need to get home. Like, you know, it's just always like that. I loved that feeling, and I chased it. I hear a lot of people say, you know, I was really good at baseball, and then I started drinking. Or my grades were really good, and I was going to go to college, and then I started drinking, and they fell off. I was never really good at anything. I just liked the drinking part and the partying part. And it turns out I was pretty good at that. You know, a lot of weird stuff happened in my childhood, which doesn't really matter. But by the time... Well, when I was 14, I broke my neck in a car wreck, being a drunk passenger, which was, it's a weird story, but I'm not going to tell the whole thing. So I got introduced to, you know, Dilaudid, morphine, Valium, things that you need when you break your neck and you're paralyzed for, you know, several months. But I loved that stuff. And they took it away after a while. I remember my mom at one point threw it away, and then I got like really sick, and she had to rush me to the emergency room, and the doctor yelled at it because I was strung out on that stuff, and I had no idea. You know, I was 14, 15. But that just went into the back of my head, and like, I didn't do that stuff all the time right after that, but I went back to drinking. And I would get in, like, my drinking changed. Like, I would black out a lot and get in really bad trouble. And by the time I was 20, 21, I had, like, a bad year. It was kind of a bad year. I got a DWI in, like, January, and then maybe one February or March, and then May or so, and then June or so. Like, by September, I had, like, six, you know, which is pretty bad. I mean, it's a bad year. I figured they were targeting me, right? I switched cars at one point, but that didn't help. And so, you know, back then we had phone books. There were, you know, and on the back there was this dude's picture, and it said Jay Fuller, DWI. And so I called Jay. We became friends. He's a judge now in Thurston County, Washington, where I grew up. But, you know, he had a way to get you out of DWIs because they filed something they didn't write legally correct when they wrote a DWI. So he got me out of it. But I had to go to this treatment, and I had to stop drinking. The treatment was called STOP, Social Treatment Opportunity Programs, right? It was developed by a guy who was on parole for, like, heroin and murder. But they thought it was a good idea. And it was the first time I didn't drink, and it didn't really go too well for me. I stopped, and I was going to these classes, and then I thought I was sober, and I was drinking a lot of, like, non-alcoholic beer, as they called it back then, O'Doul's, like, Sharps, like, such great names, right? I would drink, like, 12 or 14 a day, which just seems normal, right? Because I was thirsty, right? But I also, like, years later, I figured out, you're not really sober, because I would drink a bottle of Vicks 44 cough syrup every day. Like, that's apparently not sober either. But for years, I thought I was sober, and my life on the outside got better. You know, the tragedy that was, like, I got my best friend's girlfriend pregnant and then married her. It was weird, you know, like, it was a lot of bad things. I'm not a very good friend, but I am a good alcoholic, right? And so I had kids and stuff, and I was not drinking, and she became a problem, and I found someone else, and then, you know, we had another kid, and then I got custody of the kids, but I'm not drinking, like, and everything, you know, that's all I needed was to not drink, and my life would be okay. But apparently that's not true, because I was fucking miserable. I would work like 70 hours a week, and if I had a day off, I would freak out, like, literally, like, now they would call it panic attacks. We didn't have those terms back then. I was just like, ah, what the fuck? you know, and I tried everything to be okay in my skin, and nothing worked. And, you know, eventually, like, I got, you know, a cough, because I would get bronchitis all the time, because I smoked like 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And apparently you get bronchitis from that regularly. And then I would get, like, codeine cough syrup, and then I was like, this stuff is amazing, you know. It's got, like, a lot of alcohol and codeine. It's so much fun. And there wasn't computers yet, and so I would just go from pharmacy to pharmacy getting it, and all these different doctors, and things just escalated. But I didn't tell anyone. No one knew. And everyone thought, God, Jerry's doing so much better now. Because I could, like, take the kids to school and talk to the vice principal and stuff, which I could not do sober. Like, there's no way. I'm just too terrified of people and life situations. And so it looked like I was doing well. But, you know, my relationships, everyone close to me was like, something's wrong, I'm getting away from you. And, you know, eventually it became very clear that I was, like, high all the time. And, you know, I had to fess up and try to go to treatment again. And I thought, all I need is, like, the first time I went to treatment, I did 28 days and I was able to not drink for years. Like, I just need 28 days. Like, and I would try that over and over again. And 28 days did not work for me anymore. There was no more grace period when I got out of there. It would be, you know, the period of time just quickly dropped off. And I was willing to try anything except for AA. I did not like AA. I'd gone to an AA meeting once and they told me I was powerless. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? I walked in here of my own power. Like, that makes no sense. But if you look at my life at that point, I was actually on work release and I had to go there one day a week. So it wasn't really of my own power, but in my mind it was, right? And, you know, life just got weird and I, like, you know, became homeless. I gave custody of my kids up because I can't like subscribe to this idea that I'm powerless and I have to like listen to other people. Like my problem is I got in trouble while I was drinking or doing drugs and now I just need to not do those and everything will be okay. But the reality is everything was never okay and shit in my life just got worse and worse. I did weird stuff. I, you know, worked for a carnival for a while, and I worked for a circus for a while. You know, I traveled across the country. I did like bizarre things, and you know, I like adventures. I love short stories. Always had, you know, but like I didn't really mean to make one, and that's kind of, you know, what happened. And I ended up in Washington, D.C. I got there and like I was like not gonna do, you know, narcotics anymore. And but I ended up in like this neighborhood where they called me the white guy. And I would come home from work and I would have like $40 in cash and I would start smoking crack and I would just smoke crack all night long and be broke the next morning. And I did that every day for like a year. But I don't like crack. But I did it every day for like a year. It just makes no sense to me. And again, I'm like, fuck, I just gotta stop. I'm gonna, like, I don't know what to do. And I had a really bad night, like with guys chasing me with baseball bats, a tree branch and a gun, you know, running, hiding under cars, walking all night, like paranoid. And I ended up in a homeless shelter. And these guys, again, they were like, what is wrong with you? Why are you here? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, look around. Like, how did you end up here? And I was like, I don't know. I smoked some crack. And they're like, we're going to go into this treatment center. You should come with us. And I was like, all right. Why not, right? And so I went into this treatment center, and they were all about AA, right? And they were like, you know, you have to go to 21 meetings in 7 days to get in here. And I was like, that's extreme. But I did it, and I got in there. And then you had to go to 12 meetings a week. And the whole point of that time, I stayed there for a year and a half, twice. That's a lot of fucking treatment, man. Behavioral modification. It was me and people coming out of prison, you know, homeless people. And it was really good for me. I learned all about AA, but I still thought, if I'm sober for a year and a half, I'm going to be all right, man. I'm going to get out of here. I had to go back to Washington and Oregon and California to take care of like felony warrants I had. But, you know, to me, I'm going to make an amends trip. I'm going to come back like a hero. I'm going to see my kids again and like everything's going to be cool. And I mean, a lot of that stuff happened, but the main thing that happened was as soon as I got there, I used, and I did not mean to do that. I was not going to do that. And I, you know, I was homeless again for another few years. And I didn't end up, I was very lucky. I didn't have to go to prison. I mean, they were offering me like 7 years without any, you know, options. But I had gone to treatment. I had all these lawyers that helped me in D.C. And so they accepted that. But I couldn't stop using. And I ended up, like the state of California paid me to leave. They bought me a plane ticket and sent me back to D.C. They're like, go. And I went back to that treatment center. That was the second time. And I did the same thing again. And I got out of there. And, you know, one day I just drank. And my drinking at that point, like, I was at work. And I just worked a double shift. It was the same job I'd had before. I had the same sponsor that I'd had before. I was going to the same meetings. And I had the same head. And I don't know what happened that day, but I was walking out of work after a double shift and maybe too much espresso. And I was like, I need a glass of port wine. Because I knew the port wine was all the way in the back of the kitchen where no one would see me. And so I got a to-go cup, which was like 30 ounces. And I had a glass of port wine, that thing full, and downed it. And I started to walk out, and I was like, I should have another. And I went back, and I had another. And I had no friggin' control whatsoever. I never went back to that job. Like they fired me, you know. I just never returned. You know, that's the way my drinking was, and I would go to AA, and I would sober up, and I'd get a sponsor, and I'd go through, like, the first four steps, maybe the fifth step, and then I would drink again, and it kept happening, and I still, like, believed that if I got long enough time not drinking, my life's going to be okay. And in July of 2005, it became apparent to me that that was not the truth. I mean, I got out of the hospital on the 22nd. My sponsor picked me up. This is weird, but like I lived... So I'm going to back up. We're going to talk about the meeting because that's important to this meeting. So I was in the psych ward. I'd been there 6 times in 2 years. That's what the paperwork told me. I don't remember all those times, right? These guys brought in a meeting. And the night before, I don't know when it was, I was kind of befuddled, as they say. I was in between seizures and I was like, just fucking make it stop. That was my exact words. And later, I was told that that was a prayer, and it was an honest prayer. And I believe that to be true to this day. And this nurse came in. She'd been my nurse many times. She was this really sweet, ginormous lady. And she's like, oh, honey, you just need to let those people help you. And I knew she was talking about people in AA. And... so they take me to the AA meeting, and I remember walking in and sitting down. My sponsor says I was guided in with like an IV, cart, and my ass was hanging out because my robe was wide open. I don't remember any of that, but he's probably right. And there was 4 fairly young people. 2 of them were really young, and they were the speakers, and I was judging the shit out of them while they talked. And one of them is like one of the founding members that started this group. And that's just kind of cool and bizarre. Nobody else probably cares but me, but I think it's cool. And, they shared their story, and they, did what we do, what I've learned to do in AA. They gave me a big book. They wrote their numbers in it, and they were like, call. And the difference is, that was like a Wednesday night, and I got out on Friday, so Thursday, I guess, I called them all. And one of them called me back, and he became my sponsor. And he was like, I'm afraid to leave here. Because I'd left there many times, and if I leave there with a plan to go to a meeting, I don't make it to the meeting, I haven't been able to do that in a long time, right? And I also knew there's probably some liquor and things left in my house, and I will find them, given enough time, like 20 minutes, right? And he's like, well, why don't you wait there and I'll come and get you? I'm like, but they let me out at 9 in the morning. He's like, yeah, I'll be there about 4:30, just hang out. That's a dumb fucking idea, Chris. That's what I thought, right? Because I lived across the street. I could literally see my building across the street from the hospital, and I just sat there. I listened to him, and I did it. And he picked me up. He took me to a meeting. A bunch of guys came with him to my house after the meeting. They cleaned out everything. They took my organic vanilla extract, which still kind of pisses me off. I've never drank vanilla extract. I wouldn't to this day, but whatever. I digress, And I started, the next thing that happened was I had like a to-go baggie from the psych ward. This to help you sleep, this to stop, cravings, this to make your eyes bigger, like all this stuff. None of which, did I really need, but I kind of wanted it. And I was like, I probably shouldn't take any of this. And for some reason, something outside of me said, could you guys just take those? And maybe if I need them later, I'll ask you or something. And so they took it and they left with a plan to pick me up at 9:30 in the morning to go to a meeting. So it's like 11 at night, right? And I'm maybe 6 days off of several weeks of drinking in and out of consciousness. There's no fucking way I'm sleeping. I'm shaking, I've been having seizures, And he was like, well, why don't you try and read the book some, and I'll pick you up in the morning. Don't watch TV all night. And I was like, it just seemed weird that he said that. And then I turn on the TV, of course, because I can't. I tried to read, but I was shaking too much. I couldn't follow it. And And then the power went out. And I'm like, fuck. And I do, like, I was homeless for a while, so I know how to do an inventory. It's like, I have 7 cigarettes. I have half a lighter half full. I have no candles. And the phone doesn't work. Like, fuck, you know. And all that happened that night was my life. Well, first of all, my mind's racing. Like, it's like, you know, 1,000 miles an hour, an episode of the Brady Bunch, then like what happened when my, you know, second wife left, and then, you know, the thing I did to my mom, you know, was stealing her wedding ring, and then, you know, it's just like all over the place. And I can't fucking stop it. I can't shut it off. I can't slow it down. It just won't stop. And it occurred to me through the course of the night that the reason I was there again was my fault. It wasn't anyone else's fault. I couldn't blame, you know, my wife. I couldn't blame my brothers for showing me how to, you know, roll joints when I was 9. I couldn't blame anyone. It was Jerry. Me, my fault that I'm there. And, you know, to me, that was like my second step moment. You know, I had to admit that my ideas about the world, that idea that, you know, if I just stayed sober for a while, I'm going to be okay, it's not real, it's not right, it's wrong. And I had to surrender. And surrender is not something, I mean, conditionally surrender, I'm very good at. Like, I'm sorry you caught me texting your friend. Like, I'll never do that again. I'll completely admit it so that I can get back in my bedroom, right? Or whatever it is, like, you know, you're right, I shouldn't have done that, please don't fire me. If there's an outcome that I want, I can surrender. But just unconditional surrender, like, I'm wrong, I don't know what to do, I couldn't do it. Or if I did it, I couldn't hang on to it to stay sober. And I surrendered somehow. And, you know, I started asking my sponsor, what do you think I should do? I'm like, you know, I first of all, sentences didn't come to me very well at that point. So it was like choppy words. And I would go, I got sober in a young people's group, which is kind of weird because I was 40. I was really old. I'd be like awkwardly dressed and I'd be like standing like right behind the circle. Like, and they'd spread and I'd still be way back and I'm kind of like, what do I do? And there's like things flying around that aren't there that I'm batting at. And it was weird, right? And they just, you know, brought me along and no one was like, oh my God, like, or at least not that I saw. And, you know, they just like invited me everywhere. And I started talking to my sponsor about these things. Like, I remember I was terrified every time, like, the meeting would get over because they were going to take me back to my apartment. And I confessed to him that I hadn't paid the rent in, like, 5 months, which is a long time. And I was really scared to go in and out of my building. There's, like, cameras there, and that landlord's probably watching for me. And then he's going to send the sheriff and, like, all this stuff. And he's like, oh, so tomorrow, take some of those quarters and go up to the phone booth and call the landlord and tell him what's going on with you. And I was like, that is the dumbest fucking idea. Like, why would you ever do that? I was thinking he would say, all right, so Friday after the meeting, we'll hang out for a few hours, then me and my buddies will come over and we'll get all your stuff and the appliances so you can get enough money for a deposit somewhere else. That's my thought. But I did what he said, and I was able to walk in and out of the apartment and not be scared anymore for like the next month while I lived there. And the landlord was like, that's fine, you owe me that money. I will follow you forever. But I'll give you till the end of next month. That's like 40 days. And he's like, leave the place nice. And I did. I also paid him all his money. It took me like 10 years, but I did it. You know, and things, you know, like that just kept happening over and over. I was so paranoid about my money. Like, I owed so much money. I'd had 2 years sober in 2005, like February, I think. And I was trying to figure out, I'd done an 8-step list, and I figured out how much money I owed. It was like close to $90,000. I looked at my paycheck and my hourly wage. I made like $14.50 an hour. I was like, this just isn't going to work. So I started working on ideas of how to pay that off, right? Because you got to have it all before you pay anything. You got to have all the money and pay it all at once. Like, I used to do that. I would mess up the rent. I'd be off like 10 bucks, and I'd be like, I got to get the 10 bucks. And then I'd just keep spending it and not pay the rent. How I was in that situation with that apartment. So, you know, I was really paranoid about that. It like bothered me. I couldn't sleep very well. And so I told him, I couldn't sleep anyway, but I told him about it. And he's like, well, why don't you bring your bills over and we'll go through them. And it was very smart of him to have me bring them to his house, because if I would have tried to do that at my house, I would have freaked the hell out. That would have never happened. And so what I did was I went to the dresser drawer. And I was like, fuck, that's all bills. And I poured it in a bag. And then the next drawer was all bills that I hadn't opened. And I poured it in a bag. And I had two great big bags of bills. And I went over to his house. And I sat on the living room floor for like a day and a half. And I made this like Excel spreadsheet at the end. I did it on paper. And then we put it on a computer of everyone I owed and how much and when the last time I paid them was. And I was supposed to figure out what the interest was. I didn't understand that at the time. And then he was like, he's like, write down the contact information. I was like, all right, I did all this stuff. I'm thinking like some magic's gonna happen. Like I'm gonna show it to him and maybe he's gonna call them or something, right? And he's like, all right, now start calling them. And I was like, what? And he's like, call them and tell them what's going on with you. And I'm like, that's crazy, man. But I did it, just like the thing with the landlord, and I lost that fear. I've never been afraid about money or debt like that since then. I still owed the money, and I still had to try to pay them at less than $14 an hour for several years, you know, because I couldn't really work. But, you know, these things started getting better. And I started, you know, going through the steps with him. I had been around AA for 18 years. So I knew what the steps were. I at one point had stood at a podium in front of like 300 people and recited how it works and got it right. And like patted myself on the back, how sober am I? Right, and then I drank a few months later. So that shit does not fly. And, you know, I just started doing the things that he said to do. And we, you know, I was always hung up about this whole God thing and like, that's not going to work for me. And he didn't ever bring up anything. He said, do you believe that there might be something out there more powerful than you? And I was like, yeah. He's like, stop, that's enough. You know, and the third step was basically, he's like, I think you should do your fourth step. And I agreed with that because I knew that there would be some relief with that. And the difference was, I had written several four steps. The first one was very much going to be an epic novel, I can tell you. It was like the atrocities done to Jerry over these 30 some years of my life, right? And it didn't really help me. It was kind of fun to write. It was very therapy-like. And what I did with him, you know, I was scared. I was scared to death of going back to drinking. So I just prayed to be like honest enough and open enough, just like, please let me write what I need to write. And it became very simple. The list became very short. Like, there was no like big, long, two-page explanations of, you know, why this relationship was the way it was. It was just like, I did these things, you know, I was pissed about this, I did these things. It affected, and pretty much everything, you know, there was fear on my part. It affected my social standing, my money, my sex relations, like pretty much everything. And, you know, I just plowed through that stuff and weird things happened. Like, I read that, the four step out of the big book over and over again as I was writing it, just kept reading it. And I remember at one point, like I was writing about my dad, I've hated my dad since I was a little boy. I don't know why. I thought that he had left my mom when I was a teenager. Turns out my mom had left him, but I never knew that, and no one could have convinced me of that before I did some step work. And, you know, I saw him, as it says in there, it says, you know, we need to look at, you know, other people that are, that might be sick as people. And I was like, it would be horrifying to have a child like me. It would be absolutely terrifying. Like, they got calls at the middle of the night, like, your son has a broken neck. We don't know if he's going to live. They don't tell you that. They just tell you to come to the hospital. My dad's like an hour and a half away. He comes. I wake up and look at him. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. You know, because I'm a 14-year-old brat. Like, how? I don't even understand how he talks to me to this day. But, you know, I worked through those things, and I saw him as a person, and I've never felt that resentment towards him again since that moment. And it's weird. Like, I went to therapy for 19 fucking years. They couldn't even get close to that, right? But a little, you know, desperation and the big book got it. So, you know, I believe very firmly in the steps, and, you know, I could... proceeded, I did my fifth step, again, sober in a young people's group. We're at the fall camp out, me and 180, you know, 20-year-olds. It's a lot of fun when you're 40. And, you know, we sit in the car, my buddy Ian's car, we borrow it, and we chain smoke cigarettes, and I read my entire fourth step, and he's like, there's a lot of stuff on there that I have no experience with. Do you care if I talk to someone else, or have you talked to someone else about them? And I was like, no, I don't care. And he's like, all right, well, sit and think about it, and, you know, do what it says in the book for the sixth step. And I sat there for like 45 minutes, almost an hour, relating, you know, thinking about, have I done everything, and I'm terrified that I haven't. And then someone, you know, I had this feeling of like, I am entirely ready. I am so ready to just let go of all this stuff. And I felt like I had just done the sixth step. And then someone came and knocked on the window, and they're like, it's time to eat. And I go and get in line, and all that fucking run ready shit is gone. These people don't know how to stand in line. They don't know how to serve right. Jesus Christ, what's wrong, right? And that's my problem in life. I always think I know exactly how everyone else should behave. And you know, I don't tell them, or sometimes I do if I really don't like you, and that's not fun either. You know, and then, you know, I just live in this, like, Jerry land that just sucks, and I'm miserable. And, you know, I proceeded to go, and I wrote my eighth step, and I listened to a talk on the eighth and ninth step, and the guy was like, you know, nothing has ever given me more freedom than doing this. And I believed what he was saying, because I knew the guy, and I knew he was an absolute a-hole, and he didn't act like that anymore. Right? He's actually the guy who drove, you know, 2.5 hours through traffic to pick me up, standing in front of that psych ward. Right? And I believed what he was saying, because I knew people like him were assholes. Like, and then he's sober, and he's like driving through all this hell to pick me up and take me to a meeting, and he's happy about it. And so something changed, right? And so I did what it says in the 12 and 12, which I'm not a fan of, but in the preface of the 12 and 12, at the end of the eighth step, it says, this is the beginning of the end of isolation. And that was where I was. I'm completely isolated. I can have nodding acquaintances and friends. Yeah, I'm good. You're good. Yeah, good. Good. Yeah, good. Real good. Never really any substance. And I keep everyone like this far away. And then when you're talking, I begin to think, well, I owe that money. And, you know, she's kind of cute. And it's just like my head when I was brand new sober that night is just like bouncing all over. I can't pay attention to people. I can't let them in. And I wanted to be able to do that. I wanted that freedom. And so I put everything I had into that eighth step. And I did a lot of writing and like searching and looking at what I really did and how I affected people. And I felt fucking terrible. Like, it was not cool. It was like devastating to really look at myself and see how I affect other people. And, you know, what I started to do was I did some amends. And I would like to say, like, I was like, I'm going to go do amends. But the reality is, like, I was like 9 months sober. I'm working at this job, cooking in a federal building. They're gonna hire me on. I'm gonna be able to become a government employee. I'm doing good. It's 17 instead of 14 an hour. And the clearance should be done in the next day or so. And then the federal police come in and go, you have to leave the building now. And it's like, why? And they're like, well, you or someone with your name has federal warrants for their arrest. You need to live. Or felony warrants for your arrest in the state of Washington and Oregon and California. So I had to leave, you know. And there was no explaining that. So I started doing amends because I had to. I had no options. And it was amazing, you know. And I made the mistake of saying, talking about my relationship with my dad. I say it's a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. I told my sponsor about it. The last time I talked to my dad, he had told me, you know, don't ever call me again. If you ever get yourself together, you can write me, but I don't want you to call anymore. And what I heard was, I don't care about you. And my sponsor was like, oh, that's good. You need to write him a letter every month. And I was like, what? What do I say? Like, I agonized over like a paragraph for like a good 8 or 9 hours, like over the course of a week. But I finally had a paragraph and I sent it. And then the next month I had like a paragraph and a half. And then it got to where I was writing like 2 pages, like 10 months in. And I pulled up to our home group on a Sunday in the evening, and my phone rang and it said private number. And in the olden days, I didn't answer my phone, especially if it said private number. It means bill collector, right? Yeah. But my dad was like a therapist, and so he had a private number. But anyway, I answered it, and it was my dad. And he's like, you know, I've been getting your letters. And he's like, nothing's wrong. I'm not, but I was sick a while ago, and I thought, you know, it would be good if we talked sometimes. And it started, and we started talking. And then I had to go back there to take care of the warrants. And so I was able to see my dad at the same time. And, it started this relationship to where, you know, now that's one of my, you know, most cherished relationships. And, I tell him about what's going on in my life, business, and, you know, with my kids, with everything. And we have good conversations. It's getting harder now because he can't hear on the phone, and it's frustrating for him. He gets pissed. Trying to convince him to try FaceTime so he can read my lips, but it's a slow process. But, you know, I would have never had that relationship. I would have totally missed it. I wouldn't have done that because my thought is, like, he's out of my life. He's on the other side of the country. I don't need those people anyway. Like, none of them really liked me, you know. And, you know, they're all kind of, they live their own, my sister's religious. Like, I have all these things, right? But I love those people now, you know, for the last 15 years, I've been going back there 2 or 3 times a year and hanging out with them and seeing them, and they think it's like really cool. And you know, I've done other weird amends things. Like, my sister always tried to help me. She's very religious. She told me when I made amends to her, she's like, Jerry, the reason I went to church was because I couldn't figure out how to deal with you and the way you were. She's like, I had to find some kind of faith. And I was like, ooh, that's not good. Right? But, she's always been on my side and always looking out for me. And at one point, like, I'd done many terrible things. But at one point, like, her son was sick and he got, like, this bottle of liquid codeine. And Jerry drank it, you know, because that's what I do. And replaced it with, like, regular cough syrup or something. Because you never want to leave a trace, right? She didn't know that. I knew that. And so when her son, my nephew, was going to get married, like, they wanted to do this dinner, and I said, I will come and cook. Because I used to be a chef, and they, like, you know, cherished that about me. And so I flew out there and stayed for like 72 hours, cooked for 60 people, and came back home right after the wedding. But they remember that. And it's not like, oh, I did it because I'm a hero. Like, I don't feel fucked up when I looked at him now. Like, that's the thing. It frees me to do these things. It makes my life better. You know, and the reality is, like, if you're new, you're probably like, who the fuck cares, buddy? And I relate. Like, what I wanted to know when I was new is how do I, like, be able to sleep and not drink and kind of be at peace or still have cigarettes, you know, things like that, like the important things. And the reality is if you show up here, you know, you start talking to people, you get a sponsor and you listen to them and do the things they suggest, you know, your life can change 100%. Any of us. I mean, I was a homeless guy for like 8 years, you know, all across the country, different places, lots of shelters, you know, sleeping in front of places like this. And I thought there was no way out. And it seems like there isn't. But it's through like sobriety and doing things in AA and just like slowing down and like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, what am I supposed to do next? You know, instead of thinking about what I'm supposed to do tomorrow, when really I'm supposed to be here just talking right now. Because that's the way, you know, my life normally is. I am 100% in yesterday because those fuckers did this, you know, and I'm thinking about tomorrow when I'm going to get this or that. And, you know, I just need to be here. I need to be present in the moment. That's where the joy is. And recently, I moved here not that long ago. I have a bunch of ambitions. I was really like wound up about that stuff and like pressing really hard to get a lot, I think is the best way to put it. And what I realized recently, like just a week or so ago, is like, I don't need all that shit. What I want is to be happy today and to be in the moment and like hang out and have fun. And all that other stuff is like whatever. You know, what's important to me is like relationships, like hanging out with Brian, hanging out with Mark, Lloyd, even Terry. So, you know, I'm really glad to be here. I love AA and thank you all for listening to me.